Welcome to the Bonafide Literary Show. You have now been authenticated. Sorrentos is a solo music artist who's doing something never done before. In 2014, Sorrentos started a journey to release a song, music video, and book chapter every month until the day he died. Not Where I Want to Be is Sorrentos' first fiction fantasy book, and each chapter mirrors a specific song released that month. Get the book Not Where I Want to Be on Amazon.com and Not Where I Want to Be, the album, on iTunes.com. After 10 years in the ghettos of Chicago scrimping and saving, a group of mostly young African Americans moved from city to rural Michigan in search of better lives for themselves and their families. What they formed was a church community under the authoritarian leadership of Pastor Vera Cooley, a woman who was loved by many, hated by some, and respected by all. The novel, What of the Ranch, is the based on true event story of what took place in this community of believers from 1973 to 1984. All of the many characters in the novel are based on actual people and many of the events taken from situations that really took place. First published in 2011, the book was quietly removed from sales channels because the author thought the material was too revealing. But after the deaths and departures of several prominent community members, he thought the time was right to release it to the world. Available in Kindle and paperback versions on Amazon.com, What of the Ranch by W.B. Emerson is a novel that relates the human experience in a beautiful and haunting way. Welcome, readers, to the Bonafide Literary Show. I'm your host, Deidre Huey, the eroticist and author of La Drama Princess. You are listening to episode 10 of season 3, and I know you are ready for an author read. Clever Black is giving you one this episode. Happy joy, right? You can find other episodes of the Bonafide Literary Show on blogtalkradio.com on the Avid Reader Nation Network page. We are on Sundays at 5:30 p.m. Eastern live. Call 818-495-6960 to listen to us by phone or jump on your device and listen to us online. This show is also archived on blogtalkradio.com, iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, YouTube, and of course on BonafideLiteraryShow.com. It's always free to subscribe so you won't miss the next author interview or video episode. It's always fresh on this page. So don't be stingy. Sharing is caring, and that's why I'm throwing a new video episode at you next week. It's children's books for everyone. This video is the best of your, yes, you the listeners, children's and teens books featuring people of color. Great, right? I'm not stopping there. Outskirts Science Fiction Theater episodes are full of authors reading, so go check them out on this network page and look for the Book Tea episodes too. Let's focus though and talk about our guest right now. Clever Black began writing his Harlem family saga back home in New Orleans well before Hurricane Katrina devastated the city. Years later, he got the chance to publish his first book, They Don't Mind Dying, in his serial. And as they say, the rest was history. Since then, Clever Black has written upwards of 9 books featuring the same family, with new spinoffs and tie-ins every time. A freelance writer as well, Clever Black is the author of additional books, Outlaw Chicks and Implicit. When Clever's not writing at home, he's out on the road driving cross-country to make his living. Hello and welcome, Clever Black.
Hey, thanks for having me. How you doing?
I'm great. It is a great pleasure of mine to have you on the show. So let's jump right into it. Your Harlem family saga, you say these books are the American experience. So how can a person raised in the mountains of Colorado relate to the stories in this book? Are these books about a family from New Orleans through generations when the book is in the urban life genre? And why is it important to write books which are categorized as just urban street books most of the time? in a way readers can relate to across cultures.
They can relate to the saga because it covers a lot. You know, and I'm saying that the family originally they're not from New Orleans. They actually originated back in 1865 in a town called Silicola, Alabama. There was a mixture of Negro and Creek Indian, and from there, the story moves over to Oklahoma, where they had relatives that had lost land early on. So the family originates from the heartland, and they don't mind dying. They don't mind dying came in and kind of like put the reader into the middle of the chaos of what was going on with this family that was basically just taken apart by racism early on. That comes out later in the saga. The overall theme is showing, you know, the consequences, the devastating consequences that can happen when a family is torn apart, you know. And they still have that sense of family, and that lives on through the people that they meet. The people that they meet become their family because their blood family wasn't there. Mm-hmm. And eventually they would find one another. So a person in Colorado can relate to it because it's a multicultural saga. It's not just the story of a Native American, African American family. I mean, there are other supporting characters, and it covers a wide range of life, from the civil rights movement, things that happened during World War II. I mean, it's blacks, it's whites, it's Italians. It's like a slice. It's a slice of America. A slice of America, you know. So throughout these books, throughout these series of books, I'm sure, and each and every one, someone who is reading can find somebody that, you know, that they can relate to as far as the characters are concerned.
Okay. So I'm a lover of New Orleans, and you're from New Orleans. So I'm just a little bit curious. Why did you decide not to encompass the entire saga only within this city or at least the area? Because you said there's, you know, it's going to show the family in Oklahoma, their roots there, and Alabama. So why did you just focus on your New Orleans area?
Well, for the first two, I really did, but how the saga was written, it wouldn't allow me just to stay in the city. Like I said, the family didn't originate from there. And, you know, I also wanted to branch out and, how many books can I write, you know, with this family involved in New Orleans? So from there, I mean, I had to expand, you know, take the story to different places, because if I kept it just in New Orleans for me, for my writing and the story that I wanted to tell, it wouldn't have worked out, you know, as well as it's working out now. It wouldn't have worked out because we're in the same city, you know, this family doing the same things, and eventually they become a wealthy, powerful family. So even in most cases, when people earn their wealth, they very seldom earn their wealth in the same place in which they live. So, you know, that in itself would dictate that the locale would have to change anyway. So, I mean, we go from, mainly it's taking place in the Midwest, but it's Arizona, Seattle, Washington, some parts in California, Nevada, you know. So it's very diverse in locale, and that's another way where readers can relate to it, because they might even reside in some of those cities where some of the scenes take place.
All right, so what is the most common feedback you get about the characters in your books?
Oh, people, they get attached to them, you know, and the characters now, you know, the main thing I get is don't let nothing happen to them, you know, because they live a dangerous lifestyle going forth, and the readers understand that, you know, because of the lifestyle that some of them are living. That is a possibility, you know, but none of the readers really want to see that happen because they have a certain attachment to this character or that character.
Yeah, I was going to ask, do you follow that request that they have that nothing happens to their favorite character, or do you just write and do what you do?
I just let the basically the storyline dictates the actions, you know. Sometimes I can write around it, you know what I'm saying? But I always tell the readers that these characters aren't superheroes. Things happen. That's just the way life goes, you know. Mm-hmm. Even the best and the strongest, even they, you know, they wind up, we are all infallible as humans. And living a life of crime, you know, criminals make mistakes. Things happen. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just the nature of the business. So, you know, I never offer that promise on certain characters, you know, because of the lifestyle that they live in. But for the most part, as I write, the story kind of dictates future scenarios that take place. Like I say, you can't kill off the main. That'd be the end of it if you kill off the main characters. And you know, what's the point of that? You know, so you can put them in situations to where okay, it's a life threatening situation, but how to get out of it? But like I say, they not superhero characters, so I'm not gonna thrust them out of, you know, have them get shot 5 times and they fall out of a 12-story building, slam to the concrete, and then, you know, the next month they back at it again. We're not going to do nothing like that. But I can put them in situations to where the threat of them losing their life keeps the reader on the edge of their seat.
Okay. So in the past, you said you took parts of your life and you created characters and based parts of the plot on issues in your own life. Do you feel when you wrote They Don't Mind Dying, and as the saga goes on and keeps going, these books are a way of working through some things for you?
Not really. They Don't Mind Dying, that was like a moment where, you know, could just take a deep breath, you know what I'm saying, exhale, let it out, because I don't really think nobody really knows, you know, what went on in that neighborhood. You really had to be there. So I try to take it there with They Don't Mind Dying, you know. And I got the inspiration for Undying Love just based on everything that happened in They Don't Mind Dying, you know, because I wanted to give that character, the main character Ben Howland, I wanted to give him good parents because of the bad things that he did, you know, and kind of show that misfortune led him to become the person that he became, you know. And then from there, I just, you know, well, what if he had a sister, you know? So those two was completely made up, part two and part three. Now, when you get into parts four and parts five, the readers that read those books, they can kind of tell. Those books are kind of like joined in the hip. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You read The Five Daughters and some things that happen in there, and you read Ghost Town, and you see how those two books are closely connected. I actually, Esho was a real neighborhood in The Five Daughters, so I kind of took, you know, from my high school years and things that went on, you know, when I grew up in that neighborhood, I kind of took things, and it was a character that was in that book I kind of portrayed, and I kind of portrayed her life, put her life in story, because one of the things that happened to that one particular character actually happened in my life. And
really?
As far as Ghost Town, yeah. And as far as Ghost Town took place in Jackson, Mississippi, and I spent 2 years there, you know. So I was familiar with the gangs, with the folks in the Vice Lords, and you know, so I kind of took that. So I could say, you know, 1, 4, and 5 was kind of, you know, some things taken from my life, but the rest of them, you know, I just sat back and I built it around this family. I created these characters, you know, and called the Howland family, and I built it around that. You know, that's the main body of the story. I inculcate, you know, some things in my life, mainly books 1, 4, and 5, but, you know, majority of it is strictly from imagination.
Okay. So what is the history or background behind the slang? You just used some slang just now. You said about the gangs you mentioned. So what is the history behind the slang, the title, They Don't Mind Dying? It sounds kind of harsh to anyone who doesn't know the New Orleans street life culture.
But They Don't Mind Dying was, you know, the full saying is, we from the nine and we don't mind dying. Or you say we from the nine where they don't mind dying. You know, that was just a saying. You know, each, you know, different neighborhoods, you know, like, it, different wards had different sayings. Like, you know, the seventh ward, they call themselves hardheads. You know, they was hardheads out that seventh ward, you know. So different neighborhoods had different sayings in. I mean, I'm gonna be honest, it was vicious. The ninth ward was just vicious. It was a lot of criminals that come out of that neighborhood. And a lot of things that went on in the city could be attributed to a clique, a crew, just one lone wolf that was out there wreaking havoc on the streets, you know. It was a jungle. I mean, people in the ninth ward, they went other places and did things, but not many people came to the ninth ward and did things because there was a good chance they wouldn't make it out. You know what I'm saying? And that's real talk. It's just a neighborhood that, you know, they lived hard and they died hard.
Mhm. Okay, so you're from New Orleans. I know quite a bit about the city, but I want you to explain to people, because I often hear this question or read this question. People ask, what do you mean by wards when you talk about New Orleans? Because it's usually that's what people say, especially, you know, people, the black crowd or black culture in the area always say ward. So what do you mean by that to someone who doesn't know?
Well, the ward is it's like different neighborhoods. You know what I'm saying? I wouldn't call them subdivisions because they're all in the city, but it's just like different areas of the city where, you know, they have it's usually a housing project that's based around it. You know, so you say the fourth ward, the 10th ward, the 3rd ward, you're talking about the Calio project, 15th ward, talking about the Fisher project across the river. So it was just terms, you know, it wasn't really street term because it was a government term. But when people spoke of wards, it was always attributed to a certain project. You know what I'm saying? So when you say night ward, you know, most people would you know, coincide that with Desire and the Florida Project, you know, Desire Street, you know, things like that. So that's what a ward is. It's just different sections of the city, and you can leave out the ninth ward and, you know, you hit a certain street and then you crossing over into the 8th ward. You know, with the 8th ward, then it didn't have a project in it, you know, but it was just as hood as the ninth ward or the 7th ward, which is set in between. You know, you leave out the 8th ward, then you're in the 7th ward. You know, in the 7th ward, so when you talk about the 7th ward, you know that, you know, where they come out the St. Bernard Project. So just wards was a way for people on the streets to know where another individual was from, basically.
All right, so I just got that out of the way for anybody who may be curious, because I know there's somebody out there. So, Clever, you have been regarded as more than an urban author will you write something completely off base from what you've written so far?
Right now, I would love to do a World War II historical fiction novel based on the bomber planes. I'm a history buff, you know, and I just love learning and seeing how, you know, past cultures lived. And, you know, because, I mean, it'll come a time when 100, 200 years from now, people look back on our society, you know, and as we live, we are becoming a part of history. So this thing with mankind is an ongoing process, and we're only here for a short period of time. So I just, you know, like to look back on things and see, you know, how mankind lived, what they did back then before they had all this technology, how they lived, you know, different from the wars that they had, you know, 1,000 years ago. But I got fixated on World War II because that particular moment in time was when it seemed like the entire planet was on fire, you know, and just looking at that, a few mistakes here and there by Adolf Hitler, you know, had he not made the mistakes, we could have been here in America speaking German today, meaning a lot of us wouldn't even be alive today based on what they was doing to people. So, you know, I studied that to see how they went about winning, you know, the people that fought against the Axis power. So, and it was a violent campaign. And I take that and kind of, you can kind of attribute it to the events that, you know, that happen in some of the stories. It's like a war on the streets, especially in They Don't Mind Dying. You know, this the same thing. It's a battle of attrition, you know. Mm-hmm. Sometimes luck plays a role. Fate has a say-so in the matter, you know. So I kind of take certain things from that, can't take the concept of, you know, what happened back then and apply it to now, but the overall feeling of the urgency of the situation, that I can very well lose my life, I can die doing what I'm doing, you know. The people that fought during that war had that attitude, and the people that's in the series, in the saga, because of the life they live, they have a full understanding that they could die from doing what they're doing.
Right. So I want to get to your book, Implicit. Why this title?
Uh-huh. Implicit is, you know, it's unspoken. Everything is implied in that book. And I kind of, you know, it was just something. At the time when I tried to write it, a lot of people were saying, you know, well, what happened with the standalone novels? Why nobody writing standalone novels? And that kind of gave me the concept for it, but I put a love triangle in there, but it also had a serious twist because, you know, I mean, love triangle is certain ways that it can end, you know, but if you add a twist to it, you know, and that's what I did with it, you know, I put a serious twist on it, but, you know, it's either going to end with, you know, somebody getting killed. You know, the husband gonna wind up going back to his wife, or he gonna leave his wife, go back to his lover. The lover gonna wind up killing the husband and wife. You know, anything. But I wanted to do something different, and you know, I think I hit it out of the park with that. That book was written as if the characters knew everything, and I put clues in there for the reader. They picked it up along the way, fine. But I wanted to see how long I can carry that concept. You know, the twist of the book. See how long I can carry it, and if I can hold it to the end, you know, readers, they'll be rewarded with, you know, a shocking twist on that story.
Okay. All right, Clever. Well, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, you're going to read to us, all right?
Okay.
All right.
Looking forward to it. Now, excuse me if I stumble over some words, because I've been practicing, but... I still fumble over some of the words.
Oh, that's okay. Just go ahead and keep going if you have any problems. That's fine. Well, I'm just going to put you on hold while we take this break, okay?
Okay.
Little Brown Books for Young Readers is cooking up something new and pretty special. The publishing company has partnered with LEGO for a new creative set of books. This new venture for young readers will launch a LEGO line of graphic novels. Each one will be based on three popular best-selling LEGO properties, LEGO Ninjago, LEGO Friends, and LEGO Bionicle. This new line of books will release fall 2015 with full-cover graphic novels priced at $7.99 and will publish in trade paperback format and as e-books. The Little Brown Books and LEGO graphic novels are for readers ages 6 through 11, and books feature fun adventures and original storytelling that will expand the LEGO universe and build upon the key LEGO themes of creativity, imagination, and humor. In addition, each novel will feature exclusive content designed to enhance storytelling to further engage young readers. Read the full article on the LEGO and Little Brown collaboration at digitalbookworld.com. For more Bonafide Literary news, what's new in literature today, visit bonafideliteraryshow.com. Red Hot with Ample Curves, Marquette Rochelle is the leading lady in swinging submission, deceit, and betrayal with a multiple partner twist. In this erotic novel, Marquette is deep in the lifestyle of mixing partners with her husband, Josh Rochelle, and now she's getting down and dirty with him and her best friend's son. When it comes to Winlinda Jones, Marquette will find out once and for all what swinging is truly worth, but time is running out. Get your copy of Swinging Submission by LaDrama Princess at LaDramaPrincess.com. Dead Assets by Don Mescal. The undead arrive on the shores of Norfolk, Virginia, turning that community upside down. The natives are restless because the natives have developed a taste for human flesh. But the zombies may not be the only monsters on the block. One reader said, "I couldn't put it down. I read the first 10 chapters the first day." Dead Assets is a damn good book. Dead Assets by Don Mescal is available on Amazon.com. All right, Clever, are you ready to give us this reading?
Yeah, I'm this coming from the Howling Family Saga.
Okay.
Part two. It's the beginning chapter. A lot of people, when they read, they don't mind dying. Some people get turned off because they think that's what the entire saga is based upon, you know.
Really?
Well, yeah, they kind of, you know, they think that the entire saga would be based upon just this drug organization, you know, running around creating mayhem, these young guys. But it's way more to it. So, you know,
okay.
If people get into part two, I think they kind of get a pleasant surprise that they really enjoy the story. So chapter one is titled A Letter Home, and it takes place in September of 1944.
Okay.
And it's a guy writing a letter home to his wife.
All right.
So it starts out, "My dearest love, Veronica Jenkins. Words can't begin to express how much I love and miss you, my dear. Being far away from home in this foreign country of enemies has indeed gained me greater appreciation for the things we had back in America. Much work still needs to be done, but the atrocities I've seen here can't compare to the troubles we as a race of people face back home. In my eyes, it's hell on earth. There's no other way to describe it, lover. As you already know, every other day I sit in my P-51 Mustang and guard those flying coffins that rain down death upon occupied Germany. Flying coffins. I call the big bombers that name because so many of the men aboard those crafts never make it home. I often hear the agonizing screams of men, some I know, as they are in their final seconds of life, hurling towards a fiery crash. What gets the bombers are the countless little black clouds of smoke that seem harmless, until one explodes right beside one of the planes. The black clouds, they call it flat. It's relentless and indiscriminate towards the metal and flesh that lie in the seething white-hot pad. Going down inside one of those bombers has to be one of the worst ways for a man to die, Veronica. Pure hell. But us fighter pilots don't have it any easier, as you've already learned. I decided to name my new plane Henrietta, after this newborn baby who opened my eyes and unknowingly showed me just how serious this war really is and what it means to people like her and our surviving family. When I was shot down in June over the Black Alps, this nurse who lived in a small village of sheep herders and farmers helped save my life by hiding me inside a wall deep in the village church's basement. She gave me a baby to hold and told me her name just before she and the rest of her congregation went and approached a squadron of German soldiers who were looking for downed American pilots. The soldiers those people encountered weren't just German ground troops. They were Waffen SS. And for the Waffen, if you weren't German, then you were a part of the problem. They killed them all, Veronica. Defenseless civilians they killed. At least two dozens. They lined them up, all in front of a church, and gunned them down simultaneously. It was only by the grace of God that SS didn't set the church fire, as many Waffen SS troops were known to do. I held this baby in my arms for 2 days, and she didn't cry one time. The Germans were plundering the village, raping women and shooting old men, women, and children at random while trying to get them to tell if there were any Americans hiding in their village. Those who knew kept silent, even in the face of death. Brave people they were. I remained hidden with this baby for what felt like an eternity, and all we had was this tin kettle that I would let fill with dew at night and drink in the morning to carry us through. I knew we were in danger. I knew we were in danger. And it was as if this little girl knew we were both being hunted. And it was in her best interest to remain still and quiet. She's a survivor. On the third day, French troops, along with members of the 86th Infantry Division, fought off the small platoon of Germans that had occupied the village and rescued us both. I turned the baby over to the French troops, and when they asked me her name, I said Henrietta. Her last name was Boudreaux. I pointed out her mother's corpse as troops were lining bodies up to be identified and walked away wondering. I wonder what will become of Henrietta Boudreaux, only weeks old. I may not have the answer, but from what I've seen, it tells me that if we don't win this war, children like Henrietta will perish. I'll do my part to give her a chance at life. It is my duty to not let her fate become that of her parents and countless other civilians entrenched in this war of attrition. After seeing the corpse of that child's mother and the citizens of this tranquil village, bodies which lay stiff and decaying outside the church for over 2 days, I know why we fight, Veronica. That little girl now flies with me every day. I fly and fight people like Henrietta. I can't wait until my tour is done and I'm able to return stateside. We have so much forward to look forward to. Kids, grandchildren. I want a family for us. Tell the rest of the ladies at the sewing factory to keep up the good work and let the congregation know that the boys are fighting a good fight with optimism and victory in sight. Many of our men need those jackets and rubber masks that you are putting together for us and shipping over here to Italy, and we are very appreciative. I have to be honest, Veronica. It's not very nice over here because of the racism. But through it all, the white bomber crews know very well that the Tuskegee Airmen are the best support they could ever have in defending them against the Luftwaffe. This war seems endless, and it's getting worse by the day. I don't know when I'll be home exactly. All I can say is that my time is close. But don't count the days, please. I'm unafraid, and I expect the same for my wife. This chapter we will finish and start a new stateside. I miss your smile, Veronica, your beautiful eyes, and the warmth of your body next to mine. I love you, Mrs. Jenkins. Keep me in your prayers and thoughts, and I'll do the same for you. Love always, Benjamin. You want me to keep going? I got more.
And that's up to you. You can keep
okay,
going.
That was the, okay. I'll explain what's going on. 27-year-old Benjamin Jenkins sat on his car stuffing a letter he'd just written to his wife on a clear, starry night in September of 1944 into an envelope to get ready to send home. Benjamin was the captain of a squadron of African-American fighter pilots that were known as the Red Tails. The squadron of all black fighter pilots ran missions from bases in Ramatilla, Italy, across the Adriatic Sea into occupied Yugoslavia. And Benjamin and his squadron's job was to provide air support to the heavy B-17 and B-24 bombers that pounded Germany and surrounding areas during the violent air campaign taking place in 1944. The bombers had the task of destroying the oil refineries in occupied Poland and other countries, a strategic assignment that was extremely crucial to wiping out the German air force. Benjamin had been overseas for 2 years fighting the Axis powers. The man looked forward to returning to the United States to be rejoined with his high school sweetheart and now wife, Veronica Jenkins. He placed a picture of himself standing beside his newly named flame, Henrietta, into the envelope and sealed it and walked briskly to the mail center to mail his letter. Along the way, he ran into his wingman, another pilot by the name of Wilbur Hughes, who accompanied him to the mail center. Benjamin and Wilbur met during training in Tuskegee, Alabama in January of 1942, and they have been friends ever since. Assigned to the 332nd Fighter Squadron of the Army Air Force, both men had become aces within 3 months of actual combat, meaning they each had shot down no less than 5 enemy aircraft. Wilbur often talked to Benjamin about his family back in Philadelphia, and Benjamin will relate stories about how his wife had taken it upon herself to aid in the war effort by volunteering to work at a sewing factory back home in New Orleans, Louisiana, shortly after he enlisted into the Army. The two men walked out of the mail room and lit cigars as they walked in front of a long row of of silver P-51 Mustang fighter planes. The night air was cold, and only dim light from the headquarters, a rickety tan canvas tent, which contained a mail room, could be seen, but it soon went out so as not to give away the American position from the air. "It won't be too long now, Captain," Whitman said as he puffed on his cigar. "The boys on the ground got the Germans back against the wall in the Black Elf. Command said they may make a stand on the Austrian border. There's a lot of airfields out there. Don't be surprised if we get called up to aid the big bomber tonight," Benjamin replied as he paused in front of Henrietta. "I can't wait. We have a good chance of depleting the German Luftwaffe with their ground forces retreating. We got them on the run, my friend," Wilbur remarked. Benjamin laughed in the darkness. "What's funny? I never thought I'd meet someone who loves being in the air more than me." Wilbur laughed as his tall, lanky frame swayed side to side. He shoved Ben playfully and said, "I signed up because they told me I couldn't fly. I wanted to prove them wrong. That's the very same reason you signed up, man. And now they can't get rid of us. Flying is addictive." Benjamin agreed, just as a loud siren was heard, letting the pilots know that it was time for an airstrike. The two men ran towards their headquarters and met up with several dozen other pilots and were soon greeted by their commanding officers. From there, the story goes into the air battle, and, that was Benjamin's last battle. He lost his friend during that air battle, and, from there, the story goes back to America where he meets back up with his wife.
Okay. Are you going to keep going?
You want me
that
keep
was
going?
All you going to do. I mean, it's up to you.
Yeah. Well, I got it. There's a lot of action that takes place during the
this
air
from
battle.
The book Undying Love, right?
Yeah, this from part two of the Highland Family Saga.
Okay. So you going to keep going or you want to stop there?
I can keep going. I mean, but it's okay. Yeah, I'll keep going with it because I kind of like this air battle.
Okay.
So they go into the tent, and the general spoke loud. "Tonight we hit the oil refineries in the city of Blackhammer, Poland. You will be providing support for B-17s and the 5th Bombardment Wing. These synthetic oil field refineries are main fueling center for the Luftwaffe, and they will do all they can to defend this location. You men know your jobs, so do it well. We take to the air 2,400 hours," the general ended. Several hours later, just as the sun began to break the horizon, 319 B-17 bombers from the 5th Bombardment Wing were closing their bomb bay doors, turning to head back to friendly airspace. They had encountered relentless flak during their bombing campaign, but they still accomplished their goal by completely demolishing the air refineries, although 10 bomber planes and crews, 100 men in total, were lost in the heavy flak as they approached their target. The German Air Force was now closing in to finish off the remaining bombers, which could not make evasive maneuvers as they were too big and slow. They had no choice but to hold formation and ward off the German fighters with the 50 caliber machine guns aboard their planes. The morning sky was soon full of tracer bullets and exploding aircraft as the dogfight got underway. Many of the bombers were calling out for help. "Little friend," a term often used by bomber pilots in distress to get the Tuskegee fighters' attention, was being yelled repeatedly. Benjamin and Wilbur were trailing a German plane that had a bead on a beloved B-17 bomber's tail. The tail gunner had been shot and killed, and the plane was being torn to shreds from the rear and in danger of being shot down. "Captain, I'm going below deck," Wilbur radioed to Benjamin. "I'm going to swing in underneath that son of a bitch and get him to pull off our bars. You attack him from the top once I distract him." Benjamin looked down to the ground and could see numerous slack clouds. "There's heavy slack down below, Wilbur. They're expecting that maneuver. The Nazis are setting some of the flak at low altitude to hit the fighters," he radioed back. "Donnell and the boys are in trouble. I'm not leaving them, Captain." Benjamin yelled again for Wilbur to remain at his covering altitude, but he descended anyway, right into the flak. Benjamin opened fire on the German fighter, telling the bomb in his plane exploded in the midair. I got him, Wilbur, you can pull up now. It was then that Benjamin heard Wilbur screaming aloud, "I'm hit, I'm hit." Through the chaos and smoke, Benjamin spotted Wilbur's plane going down in flames. He watched the plane fall from the ground as he listened to his friend's terrifying screams emanating from the radio. Wilbur called out to God and asked for the forgiveness of his family repeatedly until his radio began to emit static. He just slammed into the earth. Benjamin had just lost his best friend, but he had no time to mourn. A German ME-109 was heavy on his tail. He didn't realize he was being targeted at the outset. He kept feeling small pings hitting the exterior of his plane, vibrating the metal bird slightly, and he began looking around. He quickly caught sight of the German fighter to his rear and realized that the pings were bullets coming from the German plane's machine guns. Smoke began pouring from the left wing of the plane. "Not again. Henrietta, keep that in the air," Benjamin said aloud. Benjamin knew if he turned sharply either way, the ME-109, which had a sharper turning radius than a P-51, would turn inwards and have a clear line of fire. To dive below deck meant the severe possibility of facing Wilbur's fate. Benjamin was facing a serious dilemma. The opportunity lay just ahead. Just to his right, about a half mile ahead, was the B-17 plane that Wilbur had been trying to protect, a B-17 bomber named Murderous Row. Murderous Row was a crew of 10 white men, all from Benjamin's home state of Louisiana. What made the plane special was the fact that it had a white bomber pilot that always spoke highly of the Tuskegee Airmen and requested their service during every bombing run, an act which created an affinity towards the plane for many of the Tuskegee Airmen, including Benjamin. Murderous Row was an experienced and brave crew. The bomber crew had flown into enemy territory with Benjamin's squadron countless numbers of times, and each time Benjamin and Wilbur made it a point to protect the plane. The pilot of the plane, First Lieutenant Darnell Rowe, was from New Orleans, Benjamin's hometown. The two had a good rapport in the air. Darnell always sought out Benjamin after a bomber run and would tip his wing, a way of saluting Benjamin. The man he always said was the best damn fighter pilot the Army Air Force has ever seen. The two admired one another's abilities in the air, even though they had never met in person on the ground, as the white bomber crews and black fighter pilots were always segregated. The Nell's gunners weren't slouches either. They had racked up more German fighter kills than any other B-17 bomb crew in their bombardment wing. "Murderous Row," Benjamin radioed. "I have an enemy that I can't shake. How's your left gunner? Props is everywhere. Left gunner down. Tail gunner out of commission. Engineer blown to pieces," Donnell replied, just as another cloud of flak exploded beside the plane. "I'm whizzing by on your right then. Get on your right gunner to spray this Nazi on my tail, and I'll cover you the rest of the way. If you're coming, you better come soon, Jenkins. We're getting ate up over here." Benjamin made a slight turn to the right, but not enough to get a German fighter a clear shot. He flew towards the right side of Murderous Row, and the right gunner opened fire, aiming at Benjamin's plane. That tactic was on purpose, as the right gunner knew by the time his bullets reached Benjamin's plane, he would be clear and the German fighter would absorb the bullets. When Benjamin passed the big bomber, the 50 caliber bullet shattered the canopy on the ME-109, decapitating the German pilot stall. The plane twirled violently and dropped out of sight. Another Nazi headed to hell, the right gunner radioed proudly through his oxygen mask. Benjamin, with one good wing on Henrietta, shot down two more German ME-109s that were trying to attack Murderous Row and had saved the lives of several men aboard the plane. During this battle over Black Hammer, Poland, Benjamin had attained the status of double ace. He shot down 10 enemy aircraft up until this point. 5 kills was a rarity. 10 was unheard of. Benjamin Jenkins had become a legend within the ranks of the Tuskegee Airmen on this day in September of 1944. Returning to his base in Italy, and after debriefing the generals and informing them of Wilbur's death, Benjamin returned to his bunk and sat on his cot and cried in silence as he stared at Wilbur's empty cot. The mirror beside the down pilot's bed contained pictures of his wife and two young sons. Benjamin could only imagine the heartache that Wilbur's family was due to face. He got up and walked over to his friend's cot and began to pack his belongings to have them shipped back to America. The following morning, Benjamin was back at the mail center with Wilbur's possessions and a handwritten letter to his family. "Better write too," the mail clerk said. Benjamin looked at the clerk with a puzzled look as he was handed a telegraph. He opened the telegraph and read the first two sentences. "You have been relegated to ground duty for the next week as you await transfer back to London. Your tour duty has expired. Great job." It was a bittersweet announcement for Benjamin. for good news all the more. The mail clerk then gave him a telegraph addressed to Wilbur and Benjamin, knew right away that it was identical to his. Benjamin had finished his tour of duty. Wilbur, however, fell short by one mission. The somber captain kept Wilbur's telegraph in his possession. He couldn't bring himself to put the message in with Wilbur's belongings, as he believed it would only add more grief to Wilbur's family if they were to know that he was scheduled to return stateside the day he was killed. Benjamin knew it was selfish, but he wanted to spare Wilbur's family unnecessary heartache and not prolong their grief. After mailing Wilbur's things back to America, Benjamin went and sat inside Henrietta one last time and wrote a letter home to his wife, stating that he would call her the moment he landed back on American soil and let her know the date of his arrival back to the city of New Orleans. The man had served his country and was now looking forward to spending the rest of his life with his beloved wife. He arrived home in early November 1944, having fought for over 2 years.
Hello? That's it?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm here. That was excellent. Yes. You deserve a round of applause. Yes, that was great. Yeah. And very authentic.
Thanks.
And then when you say you liked it, that scene, I could tell because you got really into that, into reading it. And that was just great, too, because you weren't embarrassed about what you wrote, and it just means a whole lot because you don't even understand. But, yes, that was great. Like I said, you could tell it was authentic. It was something that you cared about and that you liked it yourself. And I can see why people like your work so much. So, like I said,
well,
you deserve
you.
A round of applause.
Thank you.
For
thank
the whole saga,
you.
And, you know, for writing it as well.
Right. Thank you. Thank you very much. You know, and that's the thing, you know, when after you coming out of a lot of things that happen and they don't mind dying, and you read this letter, you know, from this man that's fighting this war, like what we was talking about, when it's the understanding that you can die from what you're doing, that that's a constant cloud over the man's head, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, he was the one to make it. You know, he was one to make it. As it goes on towards the end, as I begin to introduce Ben Holland's parents, I kind of explain that, you know, and that's where it all started, basically, him surviving that last day. Because without him,
mm-hmm.
just had he died, you know, if he died, then his entire saga would have had it been written differently, because Ben's parents wouldn't have, Ben's mother wouldn't have been born, so he wouldn't have even been alive. So basically, this is what undying love entails. It's the backstory of how Ben Holland, the main character in They Don't Mind Dying, came to be.
Okay. Very nice.
Okay.
So what is the key to making readers fall in love with your books to become fans for life? What do you think the key is?
A constantly evolving story, you know, not having the same repeated storylines, having
mm-hmm.
your characters remain consistent and move
mm-hmm.
and move the story forward, you know, constantly moving the story forward. You know, you have to have a storyline, and once you begin to run out of the story, you just can't drag it out. When you get to the point where you start dragging it out and you're trying to just add things for the sake of, you know,
right.
Now you know it's time. Now you know it's time to bring it to an end. But I have plenty of ideas, you know, and I was talking to one person. I'll tell you some of the things I have to take out, you know, because it's too much. And, you know, the book becomes convoluted. Because as a writer,
mm-hmm.
you know, when you start out, you have all these ideas and you try to cram them all into one story. So I use
right.
that. You have to go back and say, okay, what's the main thing that we're talking about in the beginning of the story? Because we're going to have to resolve that issue. Every chapter, we can't keep adding new issues and new issues. How is all this going to be resolved? You know, so you tell
right.
a story, basically, you know. I mean, you just tell a story, take one incident, a significant incident, and then you tell a story. You know, after the incident, you tell the effects of it, you know, the fallout, and
mm-hmm.
you give a resolution. And what I do with the Howling mm-hmm. Silent Side, I might put three of them, you know, three big instances in there. That's why the books are so long, because it takes time for them, for those problems to get rectified. But I tell the full story, mm-hmm. you know.
So what about branding, reviews, and relevancy of paperback in the current book market?
Well, reviews are always helpful to an author. A lot of people, you know, if they don't enjoy a book, they won't say nothing about it because they feel like they might offend the author. You know,
mm-hmm.
that's not me. I mean, it's an ongoing process. You know, you can't
mm-hmm.
sit down and say, you know, I got the perfect formula for writing a book, because each book requires a different formula, a different mixture. So
right.
you know, you can't have that cocky attitude. And those reviews that you know, a reader, for whatever reason, not bashing the author or criticizing the author, you know, but keeping it business-wise and reviewing the book, stating why they don't like the book. Because some reviews you put up there and something you just see two words, you know what I'm saying, no good. You know,
mm-hmm.
I didn't like it, you know. And though I would love elaboration on why a person didn't like it, you know. And even the more positive reviews, the five-star reviews, you know, elaborate without giving away the story, because it helps, you know. The author can say, okay, well, I did that right, you know, I can keep going with that. And the negative reviews, you know, I wouldn't call it negative, but I mean, that's how we view them. But anyway, you take those and you learn from them, you know, you learn from them,
mm-hmm.
you know,
right.
grammatical errors, editing issues, lack of character development, the story was rushed, timeline was off. You know, we take those things, a person that's true to the craft take those things into consideration. And I'm constantly reviewing myself. So it's some things
mm-hmm.
that I catch that I go back and correct, you know, and put it back up on Kindle once I get it corrected. You know, so I'm open to that, you know. The reviews are very helpful to the author to let us know what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong, and where we need some
mm-hmm.
things that we need to work on in order to get them fixed. And as far as paperbacks, you know, I print the Howling Family Saga. Those books, they come out on Kindle and in paperback, because a lot of readers say they want to have the books on the shelves. But
mm-hmm.
it's not really the main source of income for a lot of writers, you know.
Everything. Why do you say that?
It's done because a lot of things is done digital wise, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at it like, they don't mind dying. It's free always now, you know.
Uh-huh.
So people have those devices, the Kindle, you know, and they're looking, well, why pay, you know, $14 or $15 for the paperback when I can get it for free on
mm-hmm.
Kindle, you know. But that falls into branding, and you know, it's a marketing strategy for me. But of course, you wouldn't write one book, you know, and take that one book and put it up for free, because now you're not going to earn anything, you know.
Right.
But when I got to the point now to where I got 10 other books following, you know, and that book, I got my return and everything off of that book and some, so I put it up there for free. You know, readers, times are hard. You know, readers looking for a bargain, you can't get no more. You can't get a better bargain than that. You get to pick up a free book and decide if you want to continue on with the saga or not, and it won't cost you nothing but time. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's just my way of giving back and, you know, getting my name out there to also to make, you know, get people aware of the Howling Family Saga, that, you know, it's something unique, and, you know, you might want to take a look at it.
All right. Well, do you ever feel boxed in as an author, that whenever Clever Black writes something else, you may lose some fans?
No, because everything I do, I put my all into it, you know. I put my all into it, so I'm not just going to throw anything out there. And I also just don't want to be known just for writing the Highland Family Saga, because these books have to be read in succession, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I can't, every now and then I might offer, you know, one of the books is this usually part four, because that one is like, that one, all of them can stand alone, really. But that book mm-hmm. there, part four, features an entirely different cast, and, you know, people, you don't have to be connected to the Highland Family Saga to read that. That part four, and it's along the lines of women's fiction, you know. So
okay.
I sometimes offer, you know, that book readers, anybody interested in reading part of a series, but it actually can stand alone, you
okay.
know. So I don't, you know, I don't. When I did Outlaw Chicks, a lot of people really weren't interested in me doing that series, but I had a way of tying it in to the Highland Family Saga while it remains separate on its own. You can read the Outlaw Chicks. You can read that on, you know, separate from the Highland Family Saga. So if some
but
people that read
connected?
Outlaw, to a degree, yeah, towards the end.
Okay.
Yeah, they kind of, because, see, the Outlaw Chicks is like the Highland Family Saga's next big nemesis. So if I got eight books in the series so far with a ninth one coming. So the Highland Family Saga story has been detailed. Been, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's been what's the word I'm looking for? It's been chronologized.
Mm-hmm.
That is that the word? But anyway, their story has been told. Their story has been told. So the next big nemesis for the Highland Family Saga is the Outlaw Chicks. And, you know, they come from Iowa. You know, they got German roots. You know what I'm saying? They got whites, blacks, you know, but they're a rootless clan. So I'm telling their
mm-hmm.
story. So people that read the Outlaw Chicks and then they read the Highland Family Saga, you know, it's like pick a side. You know, who you going to root for? You going to root for the Outlaw Chicks or you going to root for the Highland Family Saga?
You know, okay.
Because right now it's like they're on a collision course.
Well, that explains a lot. So where can we get all your books?
Right now, everything is on Amazon. But you can get
mm-hmm.
On the other devices. You know, you can get They Don't Mind Dying through your iPhone, Kobo, any other reading, because that's available everywhere on all the reading devices. And
okay.
since I put the Highland Family Saga in KU, Kindle Unlimited, you know, you're required only to deal with Amazon, in which that's the biggest money maker right now. Anyway, you know, so I deal with them, and also paperbacks. I have paperbacks here. That's I sign, ship out. You know, books are anywhere from $10-$12 signed. And
how can I get a hold of those
from
you?
But, you know, just message me. I have a PayPal account set up. You know, I'm on
Facebook
under. Yeah, I'm on Tony Johnson and also Clever Black.
Okay. All right. Are you on any other social media sites?
Well, I got a Twitter account. You know, same thing at Clever Black, but I rarely use it. And you know, that's about it. I mainly you know, stick to writing my books and everything and, you know, try to get these stories out there for people to enjoy.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for being my guest tonight and reading to us. It's been an excellent show. And I want you to come back, okay?
I'd be glad to. I enjoyed it a great deal.
All right. Well, as a New Orleans fan,
thank you for having
me. Yeah, I wish you much success. And I want you to have a great rest of the day, okay?
All right, you too, Deidre. Thanks for having me.
All right, bye-bye. You come by and see me at LaDramaPrincess.com and get a free sample of this erotica I have to make your mind mine. Up next on the Bonafide Literary Show, the top three listeners submitted best children and teens books featuring or by people of color here and on YouTube. Until then, see you later.